Music and Booze with Mo is co-produced and distributed by Nitty Grits, the media division of the National Food and Beverage Foundation, changing the world one taste at a time. Welcome to Music and Booze with Mo. I'm Mo Herms, and I've worked in the music industry most of my life, so have met some pretty amazing musicians over the years. I also love a good cocktail, and I've encountered some really interesting bartenders as well. It seems that there is a lot of crossover, so when I can, I like to talk to musicians and bartenders about music and booze. Join us at the bar, won't you? Music and Booze with Mo is brought to you by The Mermaid, a cozy neighborhood bar with an aquatic flair in the Little Tokyo area of downtown LA. Open 7 days a week, featuring tropical cocktails and snacks, The Mermaid also has a daily happy hour from 5 to 8 p.m. Follow The Mermaid on Instagram at TheMermaidLA to hear about upcoming events and check them out at TheMermaidLA.com. Head to 428 East 2nd Street, Los Angeles, for a drink. On this episode, I am joined by Matt Friedlander, who, up until recently, managed Sweetwater Social in New York. We will tell you where you can find him now. It hasn't even been that long, and already he's changed jobs, but he was at the other for quite some time. But you have to listen to the whole interview in order to find out where you can find this fun guy. We did the podcast at a lively bar in the East Village. It wasn't lively because it was so crowded. It was just lively that there were people who were there, the few people who were there, were all a bunch of characters, which is something that we both love in bars. So despite it being a damp, snowy afternoon, we had a lot of fun, not just Matt and myself, but along with everybody else who was hanging out in the bar. So sit back and relax. We're going to talk about Britpop, Bowie, and booze, and Sally the puppy also makes an appearance. This is Matt Friedlander, and here we are, out in New York.
I always start this by saying, who are you? Where do you work? Tell me about yourself.
My name's Matt Friedlander. Mm-hmm. I am the bar manager at Sweetwater Social here in New York City.
Uh-huh. And how did you get started bartending? What's your origin story?
My origin story is a lot like most people's. I was in a band. We got together around the time that I was graduating from NYU back in 2003. And
are you a lifelong New Yorker?
No, I moved here in 99. I grew up in Miami, Florida.
Oh, okay. Oh.
And my dad and I did the cliche, like, travel the summer before my senior year of high school trip to go to colleges.
Yeah.
And I did, I guess, fairly well in high school. And so he had he had Ivy League set in his head. Like, you're going to go here. And so we hit up Yale and Penn and Princeton. I think at Princeton he actually cried because he was just enthralled by how beautiful the campus was. And I actually sat and talked to an admissions officer, and we wound up talking about The Verve the entire time. And I came out, and he went, "How was it?" I went, "Oh, I think it went really well." He goes, "You're going to go to Princeton." And the last school we were going to see was Columbia, and then we were going to go back down to Miami. And after Columbia, said, "Well, why don't we stop and see NYU?"
And he, you said that?
Yeah.
Okay.
And he gave me this weird look and said, "Well, why would you want to see that school?" And I went, "Well, it's on the way home. It's a good school." And so we go, we take an admissions tour, and we're walking through Washington Square Park, and it's the summer in Washington Square Park in New York City. So there's skateboarders and people playing guitars and, you know, street percussion, and there's performers and people are
smoking
weed. And I saw, and I never actually confirm this was him, but I could have sworn to you that I saw David Bowie walking through Washington Square Park. And I remember,
totally possible.
Yeah. And I remember looking around and going, fuck, I'm fucking going to school here. This is where I'm going.
And then your father's tears were of a totally different variety.
Tried to. I wound up for the, I think, maybe third or fourth time in my life lying to my father and telling him that I applied to all those Ivy League schools, and I
didn't get in.
I only applied to University of Miami and NYU. And would just pick random days, spring of my senior year in high school, to go. Yeah, Harvard said no, Yale said no, Columbia said no, NYU said yes. The problem that I found out right before I left Miami to come up to New York is that all those schools that I had quote-unquote applied to obviously never cashed his application checks.
I was going to say.
So his checking balance was not well above, but, you know, a couple of hundred or
some
a few hundred.
Some things hadn't gone through.
Mm-hmm. And he asked me about it, and when you catch me in a lie, and you can ask most people about this, I'm terrible at it. So he knew right away, he goes, ah, you never applied to those schools, did you? Well, you better fucking do something with your life.
Oh.
So, of course, I started a band.
I just see your dad's hopes and dreams just being crushed.
Shattered. Absolutely shattered. You know, I was going to go to law school and be this, you know, high-powered attorney. And it was like, no, there's something happening in the downtown New York City music scene. I kind of want to be a part of it. So, yeah, I'd always been sort of musically inclined. And
and you didn't play any instruments at this point?
No, I've been playing guitar since I was 5 or 6.
Okay.
And then piano since I was 9 or 10.
Oh, wow.
So I found a group of like-minded people, and obviously this was the early 2000s in New York City, mm-hmm. so, mm-hmm. you know, if you were in a band and you wore the right jeans and you had a good haircut, you were going to get signed to RCA, because they were grabbing everyone. They were grabbing the Strokes, and they were grabbing Long Wave and Stella Star, mm-hmm. and it was like, all right, all they got to do is play Mercury Lounge on a Thursday, and we're
done,
golden.
We're signed.
Yeah. That didn't happen. But we were
you watched all your friends getting signed. That was like, God damn it.
Whatever. They used to crash on couches just like we did.
Well, I lived in Berkeley in the 90s. So
exactly.
And that was my radio station. I went to UC Berkeley. I worked at the UC Berkeley radio station. And so the joke is that my storyline goes, Green Day used to sleep on our couches.
Right.
Because, you know, they were like 15 or whatever. And then in the 2000s when I was working in music publishing, I worked for Warner Chappell. You signed Green Day.
Right.
So then they're coming in, they're seeing me. What are you doing here? I'm like, what are you doing here?
Love that.
You know?
Love that.
It's like everybody's kind of growing up and shifting all at the same time. So.
It's that weird wave.
So you guys are playing your,
so you
got your skinny jeans.
Yeah, we got our skinny jeans, and, you know, we got the right haircuts, and we're writing the songs, and we're playing in New York City. And we start doing fairly well. You know, we're getting label attention, and we've got great management, and, you know, at that point, a lot of, I think, the music scene was, for bands that hadn't been signed yet, was really pushed by this group of bloggers that were around.
Yeah.
And they really liked us. And, you know,
did
well.
Which band was this?
What's up?
And this was, what was this band?
Oh, I was, the band was called The Go Station.
This was Go Station.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we were doing okay, but not well enough where I could, you know, just live off of that.
Yeah.
I was like, all right, well, I need to find a way to make money. And I'd waited tables in high school, like I think a lot of people did. So I was like, all right, well, I'll just find a restaurant gig and do that. So I started working in restaurants. The first two were Blue Smoke, which is a Danny Myers mm-hmm. barbecue restaurant, and Le Cole, which was the restaurant for the French Culinary Institute. And I was serving tables, which was fine. I was making good money.
Yeah.
And I kept, you know, learning more about food and wine pairings. And wine pairing mm-hmm. and, you know, second level service.
You're getting all fancy while you're
getting
not
all
fancy.
Fancy. Yeah, exactly. You know, combing my hair back when I'm at work and then immediately just sort of brushing it back forward for when I go out. And just hanging out on Ludlow Street until 6 o'clock in the morning.
You only needed 2 hours of sleep.
Oh, God. If that.
Yeah, right?
Longer living through science. I found myself working at this restaurant in the West Village called Moss. And it was this very... The chef was going for Michelin stars. Like, you know, the steps of service were super intricate and complex. And, you know, it was a very hushed kind of service and very professional. But there was this guy bartending there, I think 3 or 4 nights a week. And he had like a faux hawk and like the vest with the tie and the shirt, but just like a super cool guy. And he sort of tended to, from at least my view, got away with a lot more than he could. And people would go into this restaurant that served, you know, this amazing tasting menu and just go like sit at the bar with him and like just snack on some food and just talk with him for hours. And I started to see a lot of parallels between what he was doing and what it was like to be in a band. That guy was TJ Lynch, who now owns Mother's Ruin and Loverboy, and he opened up Low Life in Folly Beach, South Carolina. But he was the first person who was like, oh, being a bartender is kind of like being a rock star, and being a server is kind of like not at all. Just not at all. So I want to fucking learn how to bartend. So I started just sort of, while my band was, you know, in and out of touring and recording, I just started tracking down all these, you know, quote unquote senseis in New York City and trying to learn from them, and just would like saddle up at the bar at Milk and Honey as often as I could and just watch Sasha Petrosky work and ask him questions and ask him if I could go behind the bar and try stuff, and sort of kept making my way up through it. And then, you know, by the time that the band broke up, I had this new skill set and I was bartending in New York and I was working in these good restaurants and, you know, cocktail-worthy destinations, and that's sort of
Tell me more about the you seeing this rock star thing, because I've definitely noticed that.
Yeah.
It's like, you know, it's its own community, but I've also noticed, like, having a good bar team is like it's being in a great relationship, which is being in a band is being married to basically these people that you're having these creative clashes with. It's so, I don't want to say primal, but I mean,
primal's pretty fair assessment.
Is it?
I think.
Okay.
Oh God.
But yeah,
you know.
I mean, because you're hitting these emotional nerves
exactly
with your creativity.
Because you take everything very personally. Because everything you're doing, you've worked hard on, and
everything you're doing is coming from your heart.
You're expressing yourself creatively. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I used to say being in a band is like being married to four insane men
who are marriage many times. I've never been banned myself, but of course I've dated musicians.
Yeah, absolutely.
Nature of the beast.
God bless you. But yeah, being married to four different men, all with four different personalities, all four of them are insane, and all four of them are always right, no matter what. And there's a lot of give and take there. Working in a bar, working with a great bar team, fortunately, is a little more forgiving, I think. Simply because everyone's got, instead of, well, at least in most...
Is it the nature of hospitality, perhaps?
It's the nature of hospitality, but I think it's also just in the nature of, like, if we all do well, then we all do well, you know? And no one really... I mean, you don't ever see a bartender, like, hip-check another really great bartender out of the way and be like, no, I'm going to make this cocktail because I like the way I make it. It's like, if that does happen to you, then please go find another bar job. But, you know, I think there's that synergy behind it. And the fact that, I mean, and this has been said a million times, but, you know, that bar is a stage. Mm-hmm. And you're behind it, or you're performing, you know, behind it. And every single person who's come in to get a bottle of Budweiser or get a shot of whiskey or get a margarita or get one of your craft cocktails is a guest, and they're paying, basically. They're not necessarily just paying for the booze. They're paying for the atmosphere. They're paying for the experience. They're paying for the lighting, the music, all of that stuff. That's why we charge $15-$60 for a cocktail.
I know, right?
It's not because it costs us anywhere near that much as far as the liquid in the glass goes, but the atmosphere, the labor, everything that we're doing to curate this quote-unquote experience for you.
Mm-hmm.
And to me, that's a lot like being in a band.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we had someone who was working with us in radio promotion when my band was first sort of getting up there, and she said, you have to remember that everything is either a gig or a flyer.
This is making me think of social media.
Yeah, exactly. And I couldn't wrap my head around that, because I was like, well, no, like, we're in a band. Our whole goal is to make records. And she goes, and how much money are you going to make if you sell 50,000 records? And I went, I don't know. And she goes, well, I'll tell you. And she told me. And at that point, I went, I'm going to go pick up two more shifts at my bar.
do you think about, like, today with, like, streaming and such? I mean,
you know, I think...
Are you a little grateful you're not playing music right now?
I'm telling you straight up that, honestly, it was definitely easier, I'm sure, to collect royalties and make more money through different avenues before streaming came along.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, to me, it's... this happens in every single industry. Things change and things evolve.
Absolutely.
And there are certain groups or certain bands or certain people who will look at what's changing and go, okay, well, this is how I need to adapt to that, and they'll continue to thrive and succeed. Mm-hmm. And other people who will throw their arms up and go, I just can't win against this, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
There was a really, really succinct period of time in New York, right around the time that this music scene was exploding.
The Strokes music, the Strokes, that whole thing, early 2000s.
That also kind of coincided with this craft cocktail
resurgence. No, absolutely. In New York, I just spoke with Dale DeGroff, and that book came out, 90s? Well, they're doing the 20th anniversary, I think.
Right.
In 2020. So,
1990. Yeah. Or no, I'm sorry, 2000.
It was like, yeah. So that was, you know, that, and he was saying, well, you know, this was happening. There were people who were here saying, like, okay, we've got fancy Italian food and French food, but we can do what people want. We can do farm-to-table food.
Right.
It's happening everywhere else. Let's do it. And then in the cocktail world, it was like, well, we can do nice things here, too.
Exactly.
So it's kind of like, let's do all that. And it was at the same time. You're absolutely right.
It was a really, really cool sort of coincidental.
It seems like it's sort of
upsurge.
This different era of sophistication. I don't know if that's too strong a word.
I mean, you know, in my
cosmopolitanism.
In my head, I like to think that, you know, craft cocktails started because all these musicians needed shit to do, but that's obviously not true.
But you know what? This is what I was telling you before we turned on the mic. There's this link, there's this creativity that's out there. And I think musicians, chefs, you know, this is a certain kind of, shall I say, sensual. You know, it's a very... It's a very, like, what is the word I'm looking for?
It's an art form.
Yeah. It's more of a, like a, you can taste it, you can feel it, you can smell it, you can touch it, you can sing to it.
Existential expressionist release and creative.
I like everything you're saying right now. I don't know if it's what I meant, but I like all that. But you know what I mean.
Yeah,
it's like,
absolutely.
It is the arts, you're right. And the food are the arts and the cocktails definitely are the arts.
But if you think about, you know, to draw like a very, very thin analogy to streaming, you know, at a certain point in 2005, if you wanted a really well-made cocktail, there were maybe 10 to 15 places in all of New York City you could go to.
Yeah.
And now there are hundreds.
Now it's expected.
Thousands. Expected.
It's expected.
Like, you can walk into the diviest dive bar in New York City and ask for a Moscow Mule or an Old Fashioned, and you can be someone who doesn't work in the bar industry, but you kind of know what you're expecting in that glass.
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
I think, you know, what it does is it forces people to up their game, basically, mm-hmm. and to mm-hmm. rise to the level that's been set. Because mm-hmm. at this point now, it's not even the bartenders or the bar managers or the bar owners who are dictating standards. It's our guests.
Like, yeah.
You know, people who were drinking vodka soda, splash of grapefruit, or splash of cranberry 5 years ago are now ordering Moscow Mules.
Mm-hmm.
And they're asking, you know, which ginger beer do you use, or do you make your own ginger syrup? Because I really prefer mine with ginger syrup. And we're like, okay, game on. Good for you, Tiffany. All right. This is great.
Having a discussion with someone about, is the craft cocktail dead? But only because the terminology initially meant you went into a place and people had taken the time to create a specialized menu, blah, blah, blah. But now it's so common.
Right.
That, do you still call it a craft cocktail, or do you just come in to see their signature cocktail? See, you know, what they've done. Now people expect to walk into a place, and maybe you do have a ginger syrup. It wouldn't be out of the ordinary to have this kind of thing.
I mean, my whole thing is, you know, I think most things that exist in trends as far as food and drink go are bubbles.
Yeah.
You know, I there was a period of time, not too long ago, I want to say a year or two ago, where
everyone
was trying to create like the world's best fried chicken sandwich. Like, it was an actual thing happening in New York, because you had David Chang was doing one, and then Danny Meyer's Shake Shack started doing one, and everyone, and there were like a million other restaurants doing this, and then before
LA
that,
was Egg Slut.
There you go.
It's all the egg sandwiches.
Egg Slut, which I've heard is absolutely incredible.
Oh, it's delicious, but you know, I mean, it's fancy egg McMuffins.
Exactly. Before that, everyone was doing cheeseburgers up here. It was like, mm-hmm. how can we make this exorbitant, you know, amazingly luxurious burger? But then everyone started doing riffs on Big Macs, basically. The best burgers in New York were just like, okay, that's a really good Big Mac. That's a really good Big Mac. And I kind of think with cocktails, it's like, we're at a point now where if everywhere is making cocktails the right way, if we're juicing fresh every day, if we're making fresh syrups, if we're really, really taking the time to think about flavors and what appeals to our guests, then it maybe is a bubble. But the good thing about that is that now that everyone who's working has some knowledge of classic cocktails and how flavors work, it's really going to go back to, well, how do you get people to stay? And that, to me, is hospitality and service.
Absolutely.
Which I think is the most important thing about this industry.
Absolutely.
Because now, at this point, it's like, all right, well, I can go get a fucking really great Manhattan anywhere.
Yeah.
I'm going to come back to Amore Amargo or Holiday or Loverboy or Mother's Ruin or Pouring Ribbons or Death & Co. Those are my plugs.
I just saw Joaquin last night.
Joaquin, one of my Jedi sensei masters.
Yeah, well, he and I, we're both South American. We've got
yeah,
that to
absolutely.
Talk about.
Yeah,
I was like, a white boy named Joaquin, that can't be. Yeah, but yeah, no, you're absolutely right, because you can walk in and pretend you're fancy, even if you're not terribly fancy, and do just fine.
Right.
And it becomes that, and we can take this back to music again, because it becomes, when you come into a place, why do you come there? Because you like hanging out there.
Right.
For whatever reason. And you don't want to, maybe you don't want to be home, you've been in your house long enough, or
exactly.
Maybe you just had an argument with your partner and you kind of like need a break, or maybe work sucks at the moment, or
yeah.
Maybe work is great and you've just been so busy that you need some time where you just like stare at something that's not your job. Whatever it is, you're escaping, right?
Exactly.
You're escaping, you're sitting there, you're going to your home away from home.
Right.
And maybe your dream home away from home is a dive bar with a giant TV playing football and Queen playing in the background.
There you go.
Maybe your dive bar is like a beautiful place with angels painted on the ceiling.
Absolutely.
And, like very silent women serving you drinks without saying a word. Maybe
that's... But what it comes down to is just curating that experience for the guests.
Yeah.
Honestly, whatever they're looking for. Hey, Sally.
Played music, but one thing that makes me giggle about you is I think you're obsessed with Oasis.
I used...
Or are you obsessed with talking about Oasis?
It's...
Are you intrigued by the Gallagher brothers?
I'm intrigued by their eyebrows.
They're the Davies of our generation.
It's funny.
In the day they had the Kinks, now we have Oasis.
It's
extremely talented brothers that like want to murder each other.
Exactly. The Black Crowes kind of had it too, and
I never got it quite as violent a vibe from the Black Crowes.
No, because I think just because no one was watching. And to be
fair, burn.
Yeah, small burn.
Depends who you ask. But yeah, tell me about the Gallagher.
Yeah, so Oasis. It was a joke of a band. It was me and another guy playing, and we were both playing guitar. And at this point, this was early 90s. I was a teenager, and I was really into Nirvana and Pearl Jam and Stone Temple Pilots.
Yeah,
and,
like everybody in
like
the early 90s. Yeah.
And he sang in the choir at my high school and my junior high, and he goes, "Have you ever heard this song called... called Wonderwall?" And I went, "I've seen that video on MTV or VH1.
Yeah.
And he goes, "What do you think?" And I go, "It's a catchy song." And I go, "But like, I've never seen an uglier band on TV in my entire life." And I go, the only good-looking guy in that band is a singer, and only when he has his sunglasses on. And I'm like, I just don't get it. And to this day, whenever Wonderwall comes on in any bar, anywhere in the world, if a friend of mine's there, they will immediately start videoing it and sending it to me or posting it on Facebook and tagging me and going, "Matt Freelander, Wonderwall's playing." I'm like, I really don't fucking love that song. It's one of those things. But that same friend of mine played Don't Look Back in Anger for me off of
that
second album,
yeah.
Blues, What Story More in Glory. And I had never heard anything like that. I'd heard bits and pieces of that from John Lennon's Imagine and David Bowie, all the young dudes. But he'd done something, which most people, basically accuse him, which they continue to accuse him of, just like musical plagiarism.
Yeah.
But he had, done this sort of like Mr. Potato Head kind of thing, where he was like, "I'm going to take the intro from Imagine, and I'm going to throw in the chorus from David Bowie's All the Young Dudes, but I'm going to tweak it a little bit this way." It's just a great song. To this day, it's still my favorite song of all time. So at that point, I started really researching Oasis, and I bought their first album, Definitely Maybe, and that was just so gritty and raw and rock and roll, and not in an American way because, you know, they were British.
Yeah, they're British.
It's just a different kind of thing. Yeah. But, like, there was all this sustained feedback and these really crunchy, distorted guitars, and it was like, well, it's kind of like what I've been listening to in the vein of Pearl Jam and Nirvana and Stone Temple Pilots, but these guys have really, really, really well-written songs and choruses that, you know, I mean, everyone can sing along to the chorus of Jeremy, and everyone can sing along to the chorus of Smells Like Teen Spirit, because it's, you know, it's,
it's
out
got
there,
the hook.
It's loud, it's impressive. I'm like, but these are really anthemic choruses that I could see, like, stadiums and arenas of people singing along to. And we're thinking, those are the kind of songs I want to write.
But this is when you were still in a band. No, that was 90s.
I was
they
a
were
teenager.
Britpops. This is when you were a teenager.
I was a teenager.
And your band was in the 90s.
My band, yes.
Yeah, so, I'm sorry, in the aughts.
In the aughts. But, you know, that's at that point, I had sort of put my guitar, like, in the corner. And at that point, I started picking up again. I'm going to start trying to write songs. And I mean, every single song that I wrote in my teens sounded like an Oasis B-side. It was embarrassing.
No, I think that's probably pretty accomplished. Because if you're going to aspire to something, that's a good one to aspire to, honestly.
You know.
And during the Britpop wars, I was a Blur girl.
Okay.
Right. I didn't dislike Oasis at all, but, you know, there was this rivalry that they had, which I think was more Gallagher's just picking fights and everything.
I think it was Gallagher's and Damon, but I think also more than anything was the press.
But it was the press. You know it was really the press.
Like, let's sell some papers.
And then it's like London Suede pops up and everybody's kind of like, what's this Suede band? Oh, they're totally different or they're whatever. I'm like, they're wonderful too. I was more like, I love this whole Britpop thing. It's making me so happy, but I was a Blur girl. Part of it was like, that Damon's so dreamy.
Right.
Right?
And there weren't really dreamy guys in Oasis. My wife would disagree. My wife thinks that Liam Gallagher is kind of dreamy.
Is dreamy.
Not anymore.
But not anymore.
Hey, Cass. Oasis, though. Oasis, they, their albums were consistently beautiful. You know?
Noel Gallagher just writes really, really great songs. Mm-hmm. That's really what it comes
so
down to.
So do you follow Flying Birds, then?
Yeah, yeah. Love them. Mm-hmm. Seen them every time they've been in New York. Mm-hmm. It's actually a good reminder. I need to put one of their songs on the on my Spotify playlist.
For the bar?
For this?
Oh, yeah, totally. See, look at you planning already.
I like to, you know, I like to know what I'm getting into.
I maintained the Warner Music Group Spotify profile for about 4 or 5 years.
Oh, wow.
And they put out, you know, the umbrella of Warner Music labels, everything they've suctioned in there. When Noel Gallagher's Flying Birds came out, you know, that was like a big deal, and I'm like, oh, sweet, this will be fun to place. Yeah. You know, we had so many playlists that I could dabble
in. And again, like, his albums, you know, just a really nice continuation, progression of what he was doing in Oasis.
Yeah.
But to me, I mean, yeah, I mean, listen, Oasis is my favorite band. I get shit for it at least once a day.
Why?
Because people think of Oasis and they think of
the fights.
Well, a lot of people think of. They think of fights and they think of cocaine. Fights. They think of. They had three songs: Champagne Supernova, Wonderwall, and Don't Look Back in Anger. And I'm like, no, they put out like, like 7-8 albums.
If you ever come to LA, I have a friend whose job is. I always say he's the like the tour shrink for bands. When bands have insurance riders for when they go on tour, which you might be somewhat familiar with.
Yeah.
Sometimes when they're more high-end and they've got more high-risk kind of behavior attached to them, like maybe they're all former addicts or they like to beat each other up, whatever, they slap a psychologist-type person on that tour.
Okay.
As part of, not the rider, as part of the tour insurance.
Right.
A friend of mine is that guy.
That's awesome.
I met him because he tours with Duran Duran a lot, or he did for a very long time. And I'm a total Duran Duran nut. That's like, I'm a kid of the 80s. Duran Duran was my jam. I could admit that they had their time. But I love that this guy tours with them because most of them have had addiction issues, so it's part of the thing. He also toured with Oasis. He toured with Oasis simply to keep the brothers from murdering each other.
Absolutely.
Insurance was just like, we cannot send you guys on the road together unless you've got a referee.
Right.
And that was what my friend did for a living.
It makes sense. There was a very long period of time where, I mean, Oasis, and that's everything. Like, I think a lot of people don't really understand, like, how successful they were.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, they were around for a very long time.
Oh,
they
yeah.
played that show at Nebworth and
yeah,
a quarter million people. But for most of their tours from, I'd say, 95, 96 on, there was the Oasis dressing room, and then there was the Liam dressing room. And a lot of people were like, oh, Liam Gallagher needs his own dressing room. Like, no, no, no. Like, that's something the band wanted. Like, Noel, who basically ran that band, was like, no, no, no. I want Liam in his own room. Keep him the hell away from me before the show starts, and we'll be able to play. We'll be able to play our show. But if him and I get anywhere near each other on certain nights, if I've said something in the press or if he's heard something,
you're gonna have
a lot of very disappointed fans that are just gonna have to go home.
So, you writing your music, what was your music like? You wanted to write beautiful melodic things like they did, but I mean. Obviously, that's not exactly what you did.
No, I mean, you know, we wrote about...
You pulled in all kinds of stuff.
I mean, it was New York.
Uh-huh.
It was the early aughts. I was writing about what was going on in my life, so, you know, songs
about... as melodically as possible.
As melodically and anthemic as possible. So, you know, lots of songs about friendship, love, women, taking drugs, aspiring for something greater.
I've been eavesdropping. Mm-hmm. And you seem to like Wonderwall. But I like Wonderwall too. Mm-hmm. But I think I realized Wonderwall is a great song because it's not about love.
No.
It's about I'm done with you. Like, you used to be somebody I love, but it's fucking over. That's what that song is about.
Today was gonna be the day, but they'll never throw it back to you. By now, you should have somehow realized what you're not to do. I don't believe that anybody feels the way I do about you now. And all the roads that lead you there were winding. And all the lights that light the way are blinding.
Let's jump back over to the drinks then. So once the music was not in the foreground quite as much for you, creating music and you were creating drinks, did you have a similar approach to that?
For me, it came about with looking what everyone else was doing and going, all right, well, how can I try to emulate certain flavors, certain ideas of what I have behind the bar? And that was... that was weird.
We're hanging out in a bar.
Yeah, absolutely.
It was absolutely true.
You know, but basically, I think a lot of it was just sort of riffing on things and a little bit of, you know, obviously, like, a little bit of, especially in the early part, like, plagiarism. you know. It's like, oh, you know, a brown derby is bourbon, grapefruit, and honey. What if we make it with rye?
Yeah.
Oh, no one's done that yet. This is my drink now.
well, there's that. Yeah, right. And then I think of this going back to music almost. There are only so many combinations out there in the world.
Exactly.
Right?
Exactly.
So there have been times when I've heard about musicians being accused of plagiarism, and I'm just like, I don't see what you're talking about, and sometimes I don't think it can be helped. Like,
yeah.
Wasn't there something came up very recently with Tom Petty where someone paid him money? Was that British soul singer guy? Ugh, he's a dude. He's this tall, gay dude who sings amazing soul.
Oh,
you know, he's huge.
Not Michael Bublé.
No. British guy. I can't believe it. This is another me having had a drink too early in the day and forgetting all
stuff. Exactly.
Massively famous, and I'm completely forgetting. But anyway, he wrote a song that became Stay, something like that. Wrote a song that became massively famous, and someone was like, it's got notes of Last Dance with Mary Jane.
Okay.
Someone said this to him, and he's like, I guess I can kind of hear that. I didn't intend that, but I loved that Tom Petty album. So he just preemptively went, hey, Tom Petty, I'm going to cut you in on the royalties because I didn't mean to steal this from you, but evidently I did a little bit. And Tom Petty's like, well, you don't need to do that, but okay, I'll take the money. And that was one of those instances where I thought, you know what, there's only so much you could write sometimes.
Exactly.
And I think of this as cocktails. There's only so much you can do.
Right.
So, you know, if I have friends who create a cocktail and they're like, oh, that cocktail was on this menu. They stole it from me. And I'm like, really? Does this person know who you are?
There was a cocktail I came up with, I want to say 4 or 5 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just it's a gin and Strega split base with fresh cucumber juice, lime juice, and honey.
Okay.
And I call it the hashtag holy fuck. And I came up with this drink, honestly, because we had Strega in the bar I was working in. And I was like, I want to get
Let's
rid
use
of
it
this.
Up.
I want to get rid of this. And one of our chefs had just made, like, some sort of cucumber water for, like, a for an oyster dish or something. I was like, oh, can I try this cucumber water in this thing? Because I wanted something that was, Strega's just very, like, not viscous, but, like, it's a very intense flavored thing. I wanted to sort of cut it and thin it out. And I came up with this drink, and it was one of those things where it took, you know, two or three attempts. I was like, this is a perfect cocktail. And I was like, all right, well, I'm going to put it on this menu. I was working at a restaurant at the time. It was far away from any reach of the craft cocktail world.
Yeah.
But then when I started working in more, you know, in the bars that the cocktail crew tends to hang out in, it's like, no, I'm putting this drink on the menu. Hashtag holy fuck. It's got a nice ring to it. And we can deplete Strega if we have it. And, you know, all we need to do is buy cucumbers. And it's been on every menu I've ever done since. And I went into, I'm not going to say which bar, but I went into a bar, you know, that's run by people that I really, really respect and staffed by staff of people who I love. And I was flipping through their menu. I'm like, oh, they have a drink with Strega and gin and cucumber in it, but not lime and not honey. And I went, I kind of wonder where they came up with that. And I know for a fact, that no one who works at that bar was like, let's fucking steal Matt Friedlander's holy fuck recipe and Mr. Potato Head it. Because they're all like, fuck Matt Friedlander. Like, what the fuck does he know? We work at this bar. We're incredible. But it's one of those things where...
And gin and cucumber do go nice together.
Gin and cucumber go
so.
Really well together. Yeah. And Strega adds this nice little, sweetened and also herbal balance to it. And I asked the bartender working that night, who was one of the bartenders I didn't know who works at that bar. I was like, where did this cocktail come from? And she went, oh, you know, so-and-so brought it in and we tweaked it a little bit, you know, and it just works really, really well. And I went, okay, and that was the end of it. Mm-hmm. Because to me, it's like, well, yeah, I mean, some of the best songs in the world are just three
homages.
Chords. Three chords, you know? Mm-hmm. Because that's sometimes that's all you need.
And so they're cousins.
They're cousins.
Yeah.
So I've got a cousin on the cocktail menu at this really
at this
great
bar that you really love.
I can relate to them because you also have to go downstairs in order to get into this bar. and I'm just going to leave it at that.
And there you go.
and the woman who runs it is amazing.
There you go. And yeah, it's kind of like, I think if it was an intentional plagiarism, you get the sense of it pretty quickly.
Exactly.
You know,
exactly.
In terms of all that.
And to be fair, honestly, their drink, like the cocktail that they did, 10 times better than the one I came up with.
It's just different.
It's so much better. So much better. Everything about it to the point where I was like, you know what? My hashtag holy fuck, not so impressive anymore. This cocktail really, really works.
Well, Sally has just rejoined us, and I think maybe we should wrap it up because it's been like a little while. But thank you so much for talking to me about music and booze.
Absolutely.
I'm sorry. Now we're all like fiddling with Sally. Hi, Sally. I wish you could speak to us on the microphone because it would be the cutest thing ever.
Who's your favorite band, Sally?
Who's your favorite band? She's like... Isis.
Actually, no. Sally's favorites are, she loves Fleetwood Mac.
Oh.
And anything Stevie Nicks.
Is it?
Soundgarden, she loves.
Really?
Trace, what else does Sally love? Fleetwood Mac, Stevie Nicks, Soundgarden.
Chris Cornell.
She's a Chris Cornell and Stevie Nicks gal. No, I had a cat. I had a cat that loved the cocktail twins.
She doesn't like
Don't
Look
Back
in
Anger. Don't Look Back in
Anger. She doesn't. And mommy's kind of over it, too.
Well, we're wrapping it up, so if Sally could say goodbye, I'd have her say goodbye. But so, Matt, tell everybody how they can find you, what they should be listening to, whatever kind of things you need to pimp out.
You know, honestly, I'd love for people to tell me what to listen to right now because... I have no idea what music is.
He was totally behind on the Taylor Swift thing.
Really?
I'll tell you. Actually, this is a great
thing. Your wife and I were teenage girls once, so we never lose that.
This is a great story to wrap with.
Pop music wouldn't exist without teenage girls.
I agree.
Boys only listen to it because they want to have something to talk to
teenage
girls about.
Totally.
So usually, 100%. Usually at my bar when I'm in charge of the music, which is rare now because my staff has completely formed a mutiny. You know, I usually put on stuff that you'll likely hear on, you know, on any playlist that I have in my Spotify. But there was one night that I was just playing this, it was just like a generic shuffle mix of like Spotify stuff that's like hip right now. And I'm sitting at the bar and I'm talking with a friend of mine.
You at the bar?
And this, And this song comes on, and I'm listening to it. And, you know, obviously there's a lot of people in the bar, so everyone's talking. So I can't really hear what it is. Jesus Christ, Trickett.
Ah, the heckling is good in this amazing place. We love the haunted cocktail.
No. I mean, I wanted to record this here because I knew it would be quiet on a Sunday. Yeah, so, yeah.
I love shit giving. Oh, God. So you put on, or your staff has this song.
Staff didn't even do it. It was just like a random playlist just on shuffle. And this song comes on, and once the first chorus plays, I go, who is this? And I look at the bartender behind the bar, and she was like, I don't know who it is. And I think she did, but I think she just understood that I didn't know who it was.
So she saw me play this out.
And I went, this is really good. Wait, who is this? And my whole thing is, if anything's been out before 2008, I can probably wrap my head around who it is or like what kind of genre. But this was like this, to me anyway, or to my ears, this like female alternative pop rock group that had written this really, really great song. And there were two or three singers singing, and it was like, it had this really catchy chorus. And I went, oh my God, this is really great. And I kept listening to it. And finally, I went downstairs, and I pulled up the iPod, and it was Taylor Swift.
So I get a text.
And
he's like, "Oh my God, I like a Taylor Swift song." I'm like, "Everybody
one.
Likes
I like
a
Taylor one Taylor
There's
Swift song."
There's a reason Taylor Swift
else
is
get about that, yeah, where they're grooving to Taylor Swift, and they don't want to admit it.
Which song was it?
Blank Space.
Oh yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. It's a great song.
It's a great song. And let me tell you something.
Have you heard the Ryan Adams album?
I have. And I'm going to tell you straight up.
Brilliant.
If Coldplay or U2 or Oasis would have released that song as a single, hands down, at least a million copies sold. At least.
Only sold like a couple zillion million.
Yeah, exactly. But yeah, new music I really don't like. I kind of, you know, it was easier when I was in high school because I listened to the radio every day because I was driving to and from school or driving to and from work.
Mm-hmm. It's more of an effort these days.
Yeah, but since the band broke up in 2008, I don't know anything new. So I'll put my playlist on at work and then my staff will come up to me and go, dude, no one likes this stuff. And I go, what are you talking about? This is Bruce Springsteen. This is the Wallflowers. This is, you know, this is this and this. And they go, yeah, no one in here knows who these bands are. Like, no one. Can we please put on Migos? And I go, what is Migos? Like, all right, well, can we put on
fucking education?
Yeah. But yeah, they come in, they put playlists on, and sure enough, like, they'll put playlists on, and everyone's like, I like this. I'm just looking going, okay, well, I'm 37 now, and people in my bar are not. So.
Well, when you put your playlist together, you're going to just remind people about lovely things from our past.
Oh, it'll be chock full.
So they can find you at Sweetwater Social.
Sweetwater Social. My puppy has an Instagram. I don't.
Really?
But if you want to follow
I'm
Sally.
I'm totally going to follow Sally.
If you want to follow Sally, she's on Instagram. Her handle is sally.puppy.
Sally.puppy.
Well, that's perfect. And then I'm on Facebook, but just swing by Sweetwater Social, tell them I sent you, or tell me that I sent you, as Souther would say. And
then you were good to go.
Yeah.
Awesome. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Appreciate it.
Cherry lips, crystal skies, I could show you incredible things. Stolen kisses, pretty lies. You're the king, baby, I'm your queen. Find out what you want, be that girl for a month. Wait, the worst is yet to come. Oh no.
So that was Matt Friedlander, and isn't he fun? Don't you want to hang out with him? You do. But it'll be a little bit tricky. Let me tell you about his new gig. He's no longer with Sweetwater Social, although you can probably find him at the Holiday Cocktail Lounge on Sundays. Unless his new job keeps him from that, which may be the case. He will be working in a floating restaurant called Grand Banks. It's actually on a ship. It's on a boat, a very fancy boat in the harbor there in New York, New York City proper. He'll be the GM there, and they are open seasonally. So if you're there in the wintertime, probably can't go visit him at Grand Banks. But check out their website and you'll find out when they're opening. I believe that they usually shoot for April.
so that they can be serving drinks with a beautiful, beautiful view and with lovely, lovely food. The cocktails there are supposed to be spectacular, and I can't wait to find out for myself when next time I go out to New York. So that would be Matt Friedlander over at Grand Banks. Look it up on the internet to find out when they're opening up. And I thought, as a special treat, that we would also listen to his band. His band is called The Go Station. So here is a track called Not Enough. Music and Booze with Mo is brought to you by Barkeeper, a head shop for cocktail lovers, located at 614 North Hoover Street in Silver Lake, Los Angeles. Stop by for barware, vintage glassware, a carefully curated collection of spirits, and one of the most impressive selections of bitters anywhere. Follow them on Instagram and Facebook for information regarding spirits tastings. That's barkeepersilverlake.com and also in the Virgil Village neighborhood of Silver Lake, Los Angeles. Thanks for tuning in to our barroom chats on Music and Booze with Mo. For more info about today's guests and our Spotify playlist, check out my Facebook page, Mo Herms. Please subscribe to the podcast and feel free to tell all your friends about it. Lower your expectations and join us at the bar. Till next time, cheers.